This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
And good afternoon. Welcome to Washington Watch. This is Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. We got so much to talk to you about today. One of the things I want to talk at the end of the hour, is the university system, the college and university. I'm president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, and today you have safe spaces, you have microaggressions, you have trigger warnings, you have speech alerts, you have the speech police, you have edicts going on across the nation that certain students should be turned in if they've expressed ideas that offend someone else. You have quote-unquote Christian universities sponsoring a day of feminism, a day of investigating white privilege, a day to discuss the politically correct issues of the day. You have another Christian university that has launched or sanctioned a Muslim prayer room. This is all recent news. At Oklahoma Wesleyan University, we stand for the primacy of Jesus Christ, the priority of Scripture, the pursuit of truth, and the practice of wisdom. We believe that Jesus is the Son of God, the Bible is the Word of God, that truth is given by God, and that wisdom, holiness, sanctification, obedience is demanded by God. We don't have a Muslim prayer room, and we don't intend to have one. We cancel classes for a day to discuss a biblical worldview and teach our students how to define it and defend it and to understand the orthodoxy of their faith. We bring in speakers such as Sean McDowell, Josh McDowell's son, Abdu Murray, who's converted out of Islam to Christianity and now speaks for Ravi Zacharias Ministries, Joe Vitale from Oxford, who comes in and tells our students how to defend a biblical worldview. Oklahoma Wesleyan stands clearly and boldly for this kind of education in the face of this silly snowflake rebellion and this storm of political correctness that's sweeping our land. Forgive the shameless promotion there, but I can't help but tell you that education matters, ideas matter, they have consequences, and the education that you pay for and that you send your students off to get is going to bear consequences in your culture, in your living room, in your courtroom, in your church sanctuary. Your students will bring these ideas back home, and you've got to attend to the ideas that are being inculcated in them through the educational system today. So much to talk about today. First up on the show, we're going to talk about the 300 key positions that are still vacant in President Trump's administration. Whose fault is this and why is it happening? Ken Blackwell will join us for that particular segment. Next, in the second segment, we're going to talk about the recent signs of anti-Semitism that's going on across the country, like the bomb threats of the Jewish community centers and the vandalism that's taking place in Jewish cemeteries and whatnot. Bishop E.W. Jackson will be here to discuss that. In the third segment, we'll talk about Christian universities. We'll talk about the Muslim prayer room that I just brought up. And Mark Tooley, who's the president of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute on Religion and Democracy, will be here to discuss that. Because Mark is a Methodist, he's a friend of mine, and one particular university that has announced this Muslim prayer room is a Methodist institution. In the last segment, I'm going to talk about God's sexual ethic and ask you this question. Is it hateful? Many are claiming that it is. That God's sexual ethic, his standard for sexual morality, is hate language, and it should be controlled, and we should confront it as hate speech. How do you feel about that? What do you feel about that? We'll take some Q&A, and I'll do a bit of a monologue on that right now. Again, Everett Piper here, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, and I'm going to kick into our first guest here. Ken Blackwell is the former Ohio State Secretary of State. He's currently the Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance with the Family Research Council. Ken has also served on President Trump's transition team. Mr. Blackwell, welcome to Washington Watch.
So good to be with you, Everett.
Oh, delighted to have you. Thanks for taking the time in this first segment. So I'm going to load this one up, and I'm going to say, why in the world do we have 300 vacancies? There's a lot of finger-pointing going on. Who's at fault, and what can we do about this?
Well, first, let me say that you are generous. I think there are 549 strategic positions that require Senate confirmation. and we only have 14 of them completed. And so we have a process problem, and in terms of the calendar. And so there are many people who probably are raising the question, well, if we have a calendar that's working against us, why are our elected officials on vacation or on break? They should be adjusting their schedules to meet this looming crisis, because just think about it. Probably for the last 18 months, the Obama administration was busy moving people out of presidential appointed positions, or what they would call political positions, into the permanent government of civil service. And so they've been embedded. And so if we don't have the Trump team in place, many of the decisions that are now being made are being made by Obama implants. And that's a problem. Now, there are a number of ways that we can fight this. You can put people in acting positions, but their power is limited. And so as a consequence, we are depending on Congress really wrestling with this calendar problem that they have. Because if, under the present rules, we looked at that 549 appointments, it would probably be a year to 18 months before they were all completed. And we don't have that time in light of the national security threats that are out there, the challenges in education that you've alluded to in your opening statement, infrastructure that's crumbling, and the economy that's growing at an anemic rate for the last 8 years. So we are playing beat the clock, and we need Congress as well as the Trump administration to be sure to be on the same page.
Now, the Democrats are blaming Trump and saying that his nominees aren't filling out the paperwork, or that his nominees aren't qualified, and they're blaming Trump for delays in the transition. And the Trump, of course, is saying that's not the case, and the Democrats are slowing down the process. You probably, as well as anybody, can give us the right answer, the true answer. What is going on? Why is this so much slower in this particular presidential transition than in previous ones?
Well, again, I think 90% of it is the process and the clever use of the process by the Democrats to balk the system, balk up the system, jam the system, slow the system. And on the other hand, there might be a nominee here and there that has been slow in getting their paperwork completed. But that's, the burden on this is on the process and the Democrats to stop obstructing.
Now, is there anything we, as the average Joe citizen, can do to? Can we do anything? Can I do anything? Can you give us any advice?
And I think this is going to start this week in Washington, where we have the CPAC, and there'll be thousands of conservatives in town, not only doing a victory lap and celebrating last November's victory, but setting the agenda and setting the expectations of the new administration and the Republican majority in both chambers of the Congress. And so we can use the next 72 hours outside of Washington as starting to beat the drum of demand that people, in fact, roll up their sleeves, get to work, and if it means, that they have to disrupt their normal routine to get the job done, that's what it means. Just think about when we deploy folks to fight the challenges of international threats. We don't ask them, is it time for you to take a break? Can you work from Tuesday to Thursday, but then take long weekends? Do you take a break for a vacation? Those folks who are deployed fighting for our national security don't take the, you know, vacations or breaks when there's a clear and present threat. And I would suggest that our members of Congress and the administration leadership have to get on the same page, and we have to, in fact, figure out ways, and we can do it legislatively, procedurally, to defeat this game playing that the Democrats are engaged in, exploiting some rules that can, of engagement that can be changed in light of what we need to get done.
Now, for some of the cabinet positions that have been confirmed, for example, Betsy DeVos, does she have the authority right now to put her team together, or is the process being slowed down outside of her authority by people that are doing the things that you're suggesting right now? In other words, can Betsy DeVos fix her department now that she's confirmed, or is she hamstrung somehow?
There are some lower-level positions that she can fill because they don't require Senate confirmation. But a lot of her strategically important positions require Senate confirmation. And so just think of the things that need Senate confirmation. We have a Supreme Court nominee that will have his hearings. And the Congress has a budget process that they are currently engaged in. And so that's why I raised the question, you know, can in the short order, can we afford 3-day workday weeks? You know, can we afford 10-day breaks where there's no action? Can we baby the Democrats as they play their procedural games? There's too much at stake. We have to put on a full court press to get this done.
And the Republicans do have the authority to force the Democrats' hand. They can force them to work longer hours and go through a confirmation process if the Republicans exercise that authority. Is that correct, or am I misguided?
No, you're correct, and we just need to put the question before the leadership, not only in the Congress, but and not only on the Republican side. The American people want to get our economy growing again. They want to make sure that Americans who want to work can work. They want to lift our incomes. And that means that President Trump needs his full team. It is his job to get his team ready for the confirmation process, but it is the leadership in the majority party's responsibility to bat down the gamesmanship that the Democrats are engaged in, so that we can
thank you.
Get to work putting people back to work.
Thank you, Mr. Bach. Well, appreciate you coming on Washington Watch this afternoon. This is Dr. Everett Piper sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. Coming up next, we're going to have Bishop E.W. Jackson talk to us about the anti-Semitism that's going on across the country and Trump's comments to that effect. We'll come right back after this commercial break.
From defunding Planned Parenthood to confirming a pro-life justice to serve on the Supreme Court, we're going to need your help to advocate for life in the digital sphere. Sometimes all it takes for truth to be heard is for everyday Americans to use their social media platforms to advance the pro-life cause. At Family Research Council's Pro-Life Con Digital Action Summit, a diverse group of advocates who are using the latest technologies to advance the pro-life cause helped empower viewers to better reach their community on platforms like Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and blogs. Speakers include Rebecca Buell, who was able to reverse her chemical abortion with the help of the internet, and Brandi Swindell, whose women's healthcare organization was featured in Cosmopolitan as a pro-life alternative to Planned Parenthood. Discover the amazing things digital activists are doing for life in 2017 and empower yourself and your community to do more at frc.org/prolifecon.
Dan Celia, a financial issue.
I think income ultimately is the most important thing that we protect. I know one thing, and I know this from sitting across a lot of tables from a lot of people over the years, that at some point in time, maybe it's 75, maybe it's 85, there will be a point in time where the only thing you care about is how much income you have coming in. Don't let your portfolio be 100% subject to the volatility in the markets or dependent upon the market. Shore up some permanent income along with Social Security and your maybe a pension. Have some charitable gift annuity to shore that up. I hope you'll call the AFA Foundation today and find out more detail about a charitable gift annuity.
Call and speak with a representative of the AFA Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
How would you describe your health care? If you're like most Americans these days, the word affordable isn't top of mind. Well, here's some good news. There's actually a trusted health care option that is affordable. It's called MediShare. Unlike insurance, MediShare is Christian healthcare sharing, a community of more than 200,000 believers across America who share each other's medical expenses. It's about half the cost of insurance, and it's fully acceptable under the law. And here's the best part. Because MediShare is based on biblical principles, you never pay for things that go against your beliefs. MediShare is affordable healthcare for Christians.
Learn how thousands of Christians can help you save on your healthcare. For your free information guide, call 855-PSALM-23. Not available in Montana. MediShare, affordable biblical healthcare. Call 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. It's 22 after the hour. You're listening to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Obviously, he's not here today. This is Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, sitting in for Tony. Our next guest is Bishop E.W. Jackson. We're going to speak to the issue of anti-Semitism and President Trump's recent comments with regard to that. Bishop Jackson, I'm going to welcome you on board, but then I'm going to play an audio clip. Welcome to Washington Watch this afternoon, Bishop.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Delighted to have you. I'm going to have you listen to a clip here, and then we're going to discuss it. Go ahead and cue that clip up, please.
We're a very divided nation, and we have been for many, many years, decades. I mean, you go back to the founding. And I would just like to see if we could bring people together. So many bad things happening. And by the way, so many great things happening, like the museum. But we're going to try very hard to bring people together in a much stronger way. It's just so divided, so sad to see. I think it's just age old. There is something going on that doesn't allow it to fully heal. Sometimes it gets better and then it busts apart. But we want to have it get very much better, get unified, and stay together. But you've seen it, where oftentimes it'll get much better, and then it blows up.
Will you denounce anti-Semitism once and for all, just to clear up the confusion?
Well, I do all the time. I do all the time, and I think it's terrible. I think it's horrible, whether it's anti-Semitism or racism or anything you want to think about having to do with the divide. Anti-Semitism is likewise. It's just terrible.
Bishop, you're an attorney, and you're a conservative commentator. You're an African-American leader. You founded a stand, which is Staying True to America's National Destiny. I've crossed your path a couple different times. I hold you in high regard because of your courage and your spine and your conviction and the fact that you can speak so clearly to these issues that are, frankly, rending our nation apart right now. With President Trump in the mix and him being accused of the racist, people play the racism card with him because of his immigration policy, and he believes our borders should be secured, and he believes that we should do more serious vetting of those individuals that want to immigrate out of countries that are known for training up terrorists or known for harboring ISIS or whatnot. I personally don't think it's fair to label him a racist because he wants to check those individuals more thoroughly as they try to enter our country. But he's being accused of that, and therefore when he speaks out against anti-Semitism, a lot of people on the left are just rolling their eyes and saying, hypocrite. How do you respond to that, and how can you coach us?
Well, I would say, first of all, everything I've seen him do and everything I've heard him say, he said a couple of things on the campaign trail that could leave people wondering, but he's clarified those things, tells me that this is a president who truly wants to serve people who have been forgotten. And the sad thing is that the left, because they are so committed to an agenda of fundamentally transforming America, they don't like the American capitalist nation that wants to be a socialist nation. They don't like the way you deal with the nation that wants to be an atheist nation. They don't like the fact that we are a nation that really believes in trying to follow the Constitution as opposed to following our own whims and desires. But they really want a nation where everything is open, that there is no absolute morality, there are no absolute standards, everything is up to them. And frankly, every Republican to them represents a direction for the country that they hate. And so President Trump, in my view, is the victim of something. He's right. It has been going on for a long, long time, but the left has perfected this. And so they use it as a sledgehammer to try to delegitimize anybody that they don't like or anybody who's following policies that they don't agree with. So I would counsel him, keep loving them, frankly. keep loving them. Keep talking about positive, uplifting things and the direction you want to take America.
I'm intrigued by that. You say the strategy is to keep loving them. Tell us, tell me, tell the listeners how to do that. What should we do?
Look, you have to do it by faith, because we understand that when you're dealing with people who are avowed enemies, that they declare themselves to be avowed enemies. I mean, they're calling Donald Trump Hitler, and they're saying, you know, this is the same thing that happened in Nazi Germany and this, that, and the other. You know, it is difficult. You have to do it by faith. You know, it begins with prayer. You know, you say, Lord, I know that they hate me, but I refuse to hate them, and I pray for them. I pray that their eyes would be open. I pray that they would see my heart and see what I'm trying to do. That's where it begins. And I think the second thing is, you know, and this is something I've had to learn. You tried never to engage in, and this is the president, of course, he's very good at it, but you tried never to engage in personal attacks. Always keep it on policy. Keep it on the principles you're trying to follow. They're going to attack you personally. This is what they do, sadly, but we should not descend to their level. You know, Dr. King used to say, I will let no man drag me so low as to hate him. And so that's the attitude that we have to take. And I know, here again, that's not easy, but we do it by faith.
Well, Bishop Jackson, is excellent coaching that you're giving us right now. I know in the face of Black Lives Matter and these various different groups that are so aggressive against the conservative agenda, it's very difficult to respond with a logical, loving rebuttal. And you're coaching us to do that. And that is so important as we engage in the public square, is to not attack people, not engage in an ad hominem attack, and not call them names, and not resort to the same tactics that they may be using against us. We must stand up and address the facts logically, consistently, with courage and confidence, and that's one of the things you do so forthrightly, and I'm so thankful for that.
Well, look, I haven't always done it perfectly, so I don't want anybody to think that I'm sort of lecturing everybody else about what they need to do. I've certainly made my share of mistakes in dealing with public policy debates, but I'm also trying to learn. And, of course, remembering that we represent Jesus Christ, and we want people to see the love of God in us, not see hatred. And even though they're going to, you know, try to make us hateful, we just have to say, you know what, I'm going to keep loving anyway.
Thank you, Bishop Jackson. So thankful you took the time to join us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we're going to have Mark Tooley with the Institute on Religion and Democracy join us to discuss McMurray University and their Muslim prayer room at a Methodist institution. This is Washington Watch. Dr. Everett Piper sitting in for Tony Perkins. The call-in number is 866-372. I've got to find it here. 7234, 866-372-7234. I do want to take your questions. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
It looks like trade globally has seen now its fifth straight decline. Now, here's the interesting part about that. That's not good, of course. But even now, I find amazing that most of the major international organizations, including the World Bank here, is indicating that the reason that that has been is because of policy uncertainty. They're questioning Brexit as one of the reasons, even in the midst of the UK economy doing fine through Brexit. They're looking at elections in the US, South Korea, other areas, and blaming those kinds of things for the uncertainty in policy, the uncertainty about the political future of countries, and all of that uncertainty slowing down exports or global trade in general. Now, the World Bank said this increase in policy uncertainty accounts for up to 75% of the worsening of the trade slowdown in 2016. Look, here's the thing that is annoying. World trade is dependent upon people buying stuff. It's dependent upon the global economies in which a country is trading to, has a consumer confidence and a consumer spending buying things. The problem has been economic policies have created a global lack of consumer and business confidence.
Experience Dan Celia in person. Find a faith, family, and finance town hall meeting or seminar near you at afafoundation.net.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. It's 32 after the hour. Tony Perkins is taking a break today. This is Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan, sitting in for Tony. The call-in number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234, and I do want you to call in the last segment in particular. So after we're done with Mark, we'll take a commercial break, and then I am going to engage in a little bit of monologue, but I want dialogue. I want questions. I want to engage in some Q&A. So 866-372-7234, stay on the line and hold until we get to you. Christian University in Texas opens up prayer room. That's the headline. United Methodist-affiliated McMurray University in Abilene, Texas, has opened a prayer room for Muslim students. Joining us now is Mark Tooley, president of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute on Religion and Democracy. Mark, welcome to Washington Watch.
Yeah, it's great to be on with you, Robert.
Well, thanks for joining us. You're a Methodist. I'm a Wesleyan. You and I cross paths frequently at various different venues, and I know we follow each other on Facebook and Twitter, and I'm a fan of yours. I'd like to hope you're a fan of mine. And I think the reason for that congratulations there on both of our parts is that we're conservatives. And it's a bit of an anomaly within the Methodist movement to be a conservative these days. And McMurray University is perhaps the other side of the discussion, the juxtaposition with you as a Methodist, a conservative Methodist within this church tradition. We have McMurray University announcing that they are now officially sanctioning and endorsing and blessing a Muslim prayer room. I could ask you 1,000 different questions, but I think the first one I just want, how do you respond to that? As a Methodist, how do you respond?
Well, the sadness in that, and United Methodism has over 100 colleges and universities associated with it in the U.S., I think more than any other religious tradition in America. But almost none, to my knowledge, remain meaningfully Christian in their identity. They all have been secularized and were decades ago. And, of course, that's true across the board for great colleges and universities that were founded and sustained by the mainline denominations. So the fact that they would have a Muslim prayer room is not surprising, but it just reflects a larger trend that's been with us for many, many decades.
I would argue it reflects the syncretism that has been plaguing the Methodist movement for some decades. Put whatever time frame you want on it. And obviously, you know what I mean by syncretism, but for the listeners, if you don't know, syncretism is when you blend all religions together and you imply that all paths lead up to the same summit, that there are many different ways to experience and to identify with God, but they all lead to the same place. It's syncretistic. All views are in sync and basically essentially the same, and there's no exclusive view on how to find God, get to God, and to seek salvation. I think this is laden and it reeks of that syncretism, implying that Islam and Christianity have a place, an equal place, an equal footing within the worship context of the Methodist Church. You agree or disagree with me, and how do we wrestle with that?
Well, I wouldn't have a strong objection to their provision of space for non-Christians on campus if there were a vigorous proclamation of the gospel on campus, and I'm sure no doubt there are strong believers there, but it would be very unusual at any United Methodist-affiliated college or university to find a very strong proclamation of the gospel or the presentation of a strong Christian point of view across the curriculum.
Yeah. I think Charles and John Wesley would roll over in their graves to know that under their name, under the banner of the Methodist movement, a movement that was established to challenge the Church of England to return to the orthopraxy of its faith, that you've got the right ideas, the orthodoxy, but you need to practice what you preach. You need to behave Christianly. You need to behave in a methodical, thus Methodist, habitual, obedient way consistent with scriptures. I think that they would take issue with the implication that you can have a Muslim prayer room on a Christian college campus and therefore imply that their worship of Allah is part and parcel with the same worship of Jesus Christ and the God of the Bible.
Well, undoubtedly, the Wesleys vigorously affirmed the exclusivity of the lordship of Christ, and they gave their lives for Christ and to Christ. The good news is the United Methodist Church is moving in a more biblical direction as it's a global denomination, and as the Africans become the new emerging majority, they are returning us to our original Wesleyan roots. But unfortunately, what's left of Methodist academia in the U.S. is still a product of mid-20th century liberal Protestantism, and whether or not it can be reinvigorated or reclaimed by the church remains to be seen.
Now, Mark, you said that the Methodist Church is kind of having a revival and a return back to the conservation of its original roots because of its international flavor. I know what you mean by that, and I think it's the African church and other churches that are more conservative and biblical that are pulling the mainline church back to biblical orthodoxy. Can you explain that very quickly in 30 seconds or so?
Yes, the United Methodist Church, unlike other U.S. denominations, is global, so it has almost 13 million members globally. Only 7 million are in the U.S., and over 6 million are in Africa, where it's growing by a quarter million a year and losing 100,000 in the U.S.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us. I wish we could have you on longer, but we need to take a commercial break right now. This is Dr. Everett Piper sitting in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch. The call-in number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. The next segment, we'll talk about God's sexual ethic and whether or not it's hateful.
Of a newborn baby signal the miracle of life. There are some who believe that life actually begins at that point, that whatever is in the womb is just tissue and could possibly even be an accident. But the Bible shows something quite different. In Psalm 139 it says, "For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." Life begins in the womb at the point of conception, and the Bible makes it clear that it's not just tissue, and there are no accidents with God. Life is a precious gift that's meant to be treasured, not destroyed. In fact, life is so valued by God that he sent his son Jesus to be the sacrifice for sin so we could have life with him for eternity. If life is that important to God, shouldn't we do all we can to protect it? For your help in defending the sanctity of human life, thank you from AFR.
Parenting is a multifaceted challenge, and it's important that our kids know our values.
Equip yourself as a parent with resources from the AFA Cultural Institute and parenting expert John Rosemond. These four DVDs on biblical parenting address the issues of discipline, seasons of parenting, the folly of modern child psychology, and raising teenagers. You'll find all the resources of the AFA Cultural Institute at afastore.net.
Did you know there are 9,000 year-round volunteers serving with Operation Christmas Child nationwide? That's right, and local teams are still growing as God calls new volunteers to directly connect with His global purposes. As part of a local team, how would you like to invest your time, skills, and passions so that millions of children can receive a gift of love and a message of hope? To learn more about volunteer opportunities in your area or to apply, visit samaritanspurse.org/volunteerwithOCC.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. Playboy can't escape the grip of pornography any easier than the victims they've helped to enslave. 1 year after publishing its first nudity-free issue, Playboy announced that they will once again objectify women who are bearing it all. That's right, they're back in the battle against love, using its counterfeit of lust as powerful ammunition against faithfulness and trusting, nurturing relationships. Hefner's Heaven is really a road to hell, both for its victims and society as a whole. Pornography makes for a degenerate mind, and Playboy plans to push the boundaries of its own degradation. Quoting, "As gender roles continue to evolve in society, so will we." Unquote. Accounts are given of men who remember finding their dad's stash of Playboy and how they got hooked lifelong. Don't let that happen in your household. Seek the Lord and His righteousness. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. The call-in number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. I do a lot of communication, coaching, debating, encouraging, teaching, if you will, on Facebook and Twitter. I do it under the auspices of being a college president, and I think it's a tool that I can use in the public square to discuss an idea, unveil an idea, propose an idea, challenge an idea, refute an idea. And whether I'm doing it right or whether I'm doing it wrong, whether my logic is superior or whether it's inferior, at least I'm out there as an educator encouraging the discussion and hopefully giving people a positive example on how to argue, how to have a conversation, how to engage in pursuing what's true, because that is the goal of the academy. I've said many times that what Oklahoma Wesleyan University stands for is the pursuit of truth. Truth is the end goal of the academy, not your opinion. I believe I've said it on this program before that I don't pat you on the back when you graduate from Oklahoma Wesleyan University and hand you a diploma in opinions. I don't say, congratulations, you majored in opinions. That would be absurd. I hope that you've learned something as the result of coming to this institution. And frankly, when you graduate, I don't care what your opinion is, and you shouldn't care that much about my opinion, because good education, right education, truly classical liberal education that liberates you and sets you free has to be grounded in the truth and the pursuit of it. And if you want to dispute me and say, well, that's just your opinion on what education should be, well, let me ask you this. If you majored in engineering and you're designing airplanes on the basis of your opinion, please tell me which airplane it is that you designed, because it won't fly. You know it, and so do I. And if you're a medical doctor or a nurse and you're going to prescribe or administer medication on the basis of your opinion, please stay away from me. You're dangerous because you don't know what you're doing. Pol Pot and Mao and Robespierre and Stalin and Mussolini and Chavez and Hitler, all the despots of history had opinions, and it didn't end well. But Jesus tells us, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And that fact prevails so much so today in the debate over sex and the debate over marriage and human identity. I posted something this last week. It was an article put out by the Washington Examiner. The headline says, Trump to enforce Obama's LGBTQ anti-discrimination order. Now, my post said this. This is a perfect example where true conservatives must protest against President Trump on this issue just as aggressively as we did against Obama. To do otherwise makes us nothing but unprincipled political hacks. That's my quote. Now, my reason for challenging you and challenging the people that read my Facebook communiques was this. We have to be people of principle, not of power and not of personalities. We have to be people of principle. That's what conservatives are. We conserve principles. We're conservationists. We don't follow the crowd. We don't fawn at the feet of the politician or the potentate. We believe the principle is more important than the person. And regardless of who's in office, we need to stand firm for those conservative, time-tested, immutable truths that are endowed to us by our Creator, given to us by God in Scripture and in natural revelation, and never deviate. And therefore, I was challenging conservatives to recognize that we need to hold President Trump's feet to the fire on the LGBTQ issue just as much as we tried to do with President Obama. Well, I started getting some pushback. I had a pushback from Tom. Tom said, should government be discriminating against a particular class of citizens? My response was, well, I disagree. Homosexuals are not a quote-unquote class of citizens. They are everyday people, blacks and whites, Hispanics, men and women, who choose to engage in a given behavior. This is a behavioral choice. And we don't give special minority rights to people because of their behavioral choices. If we did, smokers and people who use tobacco in other forms would have minority status because that's a behavioral choice. We would give special minority rights to people who eat hamburgers versus those who are vegetarian because they are minorities because of their behavioral choice. You see where this leads. It's lunacy. The idea has consequences, and the consequences are dire. It leads to a bunch of balkanization where groups are segregated from one another, not integrated because of their choices. Our proclivities and our appetites and our inclinations don't warrant special class status within the courts or within our culture. Even Gore Vidal, an active, outspoken advocate of homosexual behavior, said this: there is no more such thing as a homosexual person than there is a heterosexual person. These are behavioral adjectives, unquote. Even Gore Vidal recognized it's not a special class of person. It's a behavioral adjective. It's a choice. And Michel Foucault, a philosopher who died of AIDS a decade or so ago, was an outspoken advocate of homosexual behavior, but he warned that we were creating what he called an hermaphrodism, a false species, by focusing human identity on the appetite, the inclination, the proclivity, i.e. the behavioral choice, rather than recognizing that human identity is bigger and better than that. I've said before, you are the imago Dei. You're created in the image of God. Your identity is found in Christ. It's found in that fact that you have the stamp of God imprinted on your soul. You're the imago Dei. You're not the imago dog. You're not made in the image of an animal. You don't have to follow your every appetite and inclination. You can choose to do otherwise, and God help us if we don't. The human identity is much more than your base inclinations. There are lots of things I'm inclined to do, and so are you, that we should choose not to. I'm inclined to cheat. I would much rather let you do all the work in studying for a test and me sit behind you and look over your shoulder and copy your answers. I don't have to do the work. I'll get a good grade because you did the work for me. I'm inclined to do that, but I know I'm not supposed to, and my integrity and my identity in Christ calls upon me to eschew that appetite, that proclivity, that inclination, and not do it. That's what moral culpability assumes. And without that moral fiber, moral culpability, we're not human. We're not the Imago Dei. We're nothing but the Imago Dog. Agree or disagree? I've got a couple people waiting to comment. I don't know if it's on this or some other issue, but Zach in Kansas, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, thanks a lot. I just wanted to say that I've heard you articulate issues around gender confusion, and I think you've done a better job than anyone I've heard, so thank you for that. But I wanted to comment on an earlier conversation. You know, do any of the major religious leaders, whether it be Jesus Christ or Muhammad or Buddha, would any of them agree or prescribe to this idea that the religions are the same? And how do people get lost in being so disconnected from, those teachings of the, you know, the primary leaders of their religion?
Excellent question. Spot on question, Zach. And let me just give a brief answer. But I'm going to also encourage you to go to a couple different websites if you care to learn more about this particular answer, and a cheat sheet, if you will. Thepoachedegg.net, or you can get it by thepoachedegg.org, is a great cheat sheet on Christian apologetics and getting answers on a lot of these questions. I use it all the time. Go to The Poached Egg, great resource. Go to the Colson Center. The Colson Center has great resources on worldview. And I would also encourage you to go to Ravi Zacharias Ministries, RZIM. They have wonderful resources. The Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics is underneath the umbrella of RZIM, and they've got great scholars to answer your questions. But let me give you a quick answer. It's an insult to Islam to suggest that it and Christianity are the same. Any good Muslim would be offended if you told him that his religion was essentially the same as Christianity. He, the Muslim, recognizes the exclusive claims of Islam, and he recognizes the exclusive claims of Christianity. He recognizes that they're antithetical to one another, and you can't have it both ways. If you go to the Dome of the Rock on Temple Mount in Jerusalem, the Dome of the Rock is the Muslim mosque that's constructed there on the site where Solomon's temple was. The Dome of the Rock has Arabic inscriptions around the perimeter of it. If you go look at a picture of it right now, you'll see huge Arabic letters that surround the entire circumference of the Dome of the Rock, the base of it. What do those letters say? Those are Quranic verses that specifically refute the Trinity, the virgin birth, and the deity of Jesus Christ. Now, why? It's because Islam recognizes that in its view, it is it's hypocrisy. It is heresy to suggest that God would have a father. Excuse me. And that, yes, well, yeah, I say it that way, that God would have a father because Jesus claims to be, and Christianity, because the Trinity claims that Jesus is the Son of God. That very phrase, Son of God, is heresy to Islam. Because God does not procreate in Islam. God does not have a son, and you can't have two in one or three in one. So Islam believes that Christianity's claim of a Trinity is heresy because of the exclusive claims of Islam. I could go on and on, but the answer to your question, Zach, is this. No, other religions recognize the exclusive claims of their faith. Christianity needs to recognize the exclusive claims of our faith. Ravi Zacharias said it best. He once was asked if all paths lead to the same summit, that there are multiple ways to God and that we all are basically worshiping the same God and we all essentially agree. And his response was essentially this. Yes, I suppose we all do worship the same God and all paths do lead to the same summit, except in matters of sexuality and morality and salvation and eternity, the definition of God, the definition of sin, the definition of hell, and the definition of heaven. I suppose if you set all these minor issues aside, all paths do lead to the same God. Zacharias's response is perfect. He points out the fact that we have exclusive claims in all of those areas. We dispute one another in all of those areas. We don't agree about the definition of God, the definition of salvation, the definition of eternity, and the definition of heaven and hell. We don't agree on those things. We therefore have to start studying as to who's right and who's wrong. Mac in Arkansas, are you still with me? Welcome. Ron, I guess we lost Mac, so I'm going to go to Ron in Ohio. Ron, are you still with me?
I am. Thank you, Doctor.
Welcome to Washington Watch.
I specifically wanted to speak to the sexual issue. You had such a complete package there, so I can only offer this from a biblical standpoint. You know, at a very young age, I was chronic, went on to, you know, pornography and all of that throughout my young life. I knew even at that young age that it was a sort of a self-medication. You know, I was bullied as a kid, and it was just, in my mind, it was that, I keep thinking of that lyric that Paul Simon said about the hookers on 7th Avenue. He'd take some comfort there, and I felt like that was a strange way of self-medicating myself. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it wasn't until I was much older that I realized that even there, the chemistry behind that is, I think, unique, because once you set that pattern up, you ingrain it deeply, if you follow me. In other words, your mind can summon up a thought that will stimulate the chemicals. You know, there's a loop that gets created. My point is, it's very, very difficult when the basis of it has been just a sort of a way to self-medicate. But I knew, as I became a young man, I knew it had really nothing to do with sex, because you would just continue to pursue.
Thank you, Ron. Spot on. And I think one of the things I'd like to point out in response to you right now, Ron, is this. I'll quote Josh McDowell. Josh has blessed Oklahoma Wesleyan University by giving his name to us. We have the Josh McDowell Institute for Christian Thought and Apologetics here. Josh is of the conviction today that until we address the issue of pornography and sexual addiction and immorality, that we're never going to be able to speak to the mind and effectively and logically win people to the Lord. And his reason is this: we are so enslaved chemically, physiologically to pornography when we start imbibing it that we can't kick the habit, and therefore our mind is corrupted and given over in a reprobate fashion to these passions. The passion overrules the logic. Josh is finding that he can't speak effectively, apologetically, and rationally and logically to a group and to a population until he first confronts the issue of pornography and the issue of sexual addiction, because it's so rampant in our culture, not just in the United States, but worldwide. This has been an interesting discussion this afternoon. We could go on and on so much, but I want to leave you with this. Remember that your identity is found in Jesus Christ. Your identity is the Imago Dei. Your identity is not in your inclinations, in your passions, in your appetites. You can choose through confession and repentance to give yourself over to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. This is Dr. Everett Piper. You can follow me on Twitter. It's Dr. Everett Piper, DreverettPiper. Been honored to sit in this afternoon as the host for Washington Watch. Bless you, and have a great evening.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.